and welcome once again to Crazy Comics and Stories. It's me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rap Bastard. And at the other end of the series of tubes and wires that we call the internets is Joe, Crazy Writer. How you doing today, Joe?
What day is it?
Sunday.
Sunday
at the U.S. All... 30 Drag Strip with the great ones. Run.
Oh, dude, you're worse than the real thing. It's, I don't know. It's just, I'm losing track of my days because of the weird work schedule I got. And last night I got home and I decided Chris is gone. The kids were gone. I thought it'd be a good time to have a meal of coleslaw and fireball. Yum. It works. Coleslaw. I mean, the fireballs gives and a little. Ooh, I cheap, love coleslaw.
Cheap booze.
Yes. Yes. It was great. Cinnamony, burny. And then the coleslaw was creamy and cold. It was almost like a perfect combo. And then I kind of, because I'm not a established drinker. Oh, I've got nice and hammered. And that was only like two shots of fireball. I'm a cheap date. So you ever get me out for a drink, you know, I can be had for a couple fireballs. And then I went crazy. I mean, I had half a Hershey's milk chocolate and Reese's Pieces king size bar. We had no bread, so I had some cheese in a hamburger bun and a couple potato chips.
64 slices of American cheese.
Yeah, I downed about three of them. Actually, it was provolone today. As a kind of, I was like, whatever. I think I'll eat this. Yeah, it tastes good. Oh, yeah, a couple of handfuls of goldfish. Sorry, Bun, here, have one. And then when I, since no one was home, I figured I'd do one of two things. I'd either start eBaying or I would start watching TV or maybe read some comics. I just found my way to bed and just kind of, I had to make sure I was moving the direction the earth was. Otherwise, I'd have been up all night. So that was good. Oh, I did get up at about 3 in the morning and down some ibuprofen and drink about, 12 ounces of water, just in case. I still got oxycodone from my lung surgery, my hip surgery, but I'd like, better not on top of fireball. Not a good combo. Besides, there's always tomorrow night. Tonight.
What's tomorrow night?
Maybe we'll do it now. I'll do it during the podcast. Folks. Here's Joe overdosing on oxycodone and fireball. Corey, I tell you, man, I love you.
Overdosing on booze and pills is not how I thought you would go.
Yeah.
We're not famous enough for that. You're not famous enough to do the Amy Winehouse.
You would be pissed at me, too, because, yeah, damn it, I lost out on that one. It wasn't all bad. And again, I want to touch on briefly, I did go to Mike Edmondson's wake celebration of life. It was kind of interesting because he'd been cremated. And then he also, you'd go into one room and pick a sticker and bring it back and put it on his box. Because, he's, when you cremate, you get put into a little box. And so when we got there were all sorts of stickers all over his box. And I never did actually get a sticker on the box. I'll tell you why in a moment. But I was thinking I should have brought one of those big old fashioned Hot Comics East bumper stickers, that would like covered the entire box. Would have been a little ostentatious, but whatever. That's me. But guys from the MCBA were there. Butch. I hooked up with Butch and we went. Corey, I know you were busy working, unfortunately. And it was, I think I like this idea of having a celebration of life instead of mourning, because a lot of stories, a lot of talk, seeing people you haven't seen in a while. And really, you should reach out and see more often. At the end of the night, when Butch and I basically sat in his driveway and just talked for like 2 hours, and we were like, I better call it because I got to get up and work the next day. Actually just took a 10-hour vacation day just to go to it. you know, sometimes the wakes throw me. Like when a friend of mine, his brother passed away. And I went not because I knew the brother, but because I was there for my friend. And that one I didn't really hang at much. But I think of like the celebration when Nick passed away and then this now with Mike. But I think that's really the way to go. Just, you know, remember the life, remember the stories. We're going to miss them. I mean, when Butch and I walked in, Lisa saw us and just broke into tears. And it was just, you know, she just said she's been doing that. I think it's so soon for everybody. We're still processing. And really the litmus test will be when the con happens and, you know, Mikey's not there. It's kind of like when Nick passed. It took me forever to get back to the source. You know, I didn't want to go. And then you're thinking, well, that's not what Nick would have wanted. But it was, like I said, most people were in masks. Gruba, dumbass, didn't. You know, for a guy who's high risk because of the cancer he had at the beginning of the year, the fact that he doesn't wear a mask astounds me. You know, it's sad that nowadays you can tell someone's political persuasion by how they view masks. Although I did see some
masks online. And also you can tell how they see other people.
Yeah.
Do they care about other people or not?
And the weird thing is Pat works, his girlfriend works, you know, with people like you do, not mentally disabled, but in a home with older people. So she's in the like frontline battle of this stuff. But whatever, it was nice. You know, I'm glad Pat came because I felt bad. I know Pat and I had been trading phone messages ever since we heard Mike passed away. And I kept thinking, I wonder if I should call him. I should have reached out maybe one last time to see if he wanted to come with us. But I'm glad he came in. You know, we weren't quite sure if we were going to, you know, fist bump or whatever. We said, no, Pat, you and me, we do the hugs. So a lot of hugs once people got over the, well, I guess it just took one person to get a hug and everybody started going. But it was kind of nice. A couple things that happened. I met for the first time Mike's parents.
Oh,
when Mike started working for me. Hang on a second here. I gotta, because I'm not smart enough to have everything ready before a podcast. I gotta walk way the hell down the hallway and get this. I don't know why I saved these. I think it's a remembrance thing. But I got the little brochure they made for Mike. Brochure. Yeah. Hey, here. You just missed Mike Dell Edmondson. Did you know his middle name was Dell?
I did not.
Did you know he led? I don't know if this is true or not. Somebody said he actually had a scholarship to play football.
That would not surprise me, but I did not know it.
But he also messed up his knee.
Yeah,
I know
that I knew.
And that's what I think killed the football thing. So it was kind of nice to meet him. I told his parents the story of, you know, I Mike and I never knew how he got hired at my shop. We think it's because he left Target and I hired him. Although I got to say now the story's in doubt because I will. And we'll get to that because, you know, I just want to talk about it. But Mike, he was born March 21st, 1971, passed away at 49 years of age. So I'm 55. I'm not going to do math. So, and when I started the shop, I was 26. So he was fairly young when he started working for me. And it was nice because not only did they have the brochure, you know, the little memory card, but they had variant covers on it. So you had to try to get them all. No, they didn't. That was the joke running that all the MCB got. Hey, make sure you get the variant cover. But they got it was just very nice. I to meet the parents were cool. And they're like, were you at the wedding? I said I was, but I was one of the comic guys. I'm going to have to get a hold of Lisa because she started. Terrence Greep came in and gave her such a wonderful write-up because I was saying, I don't understand. One thing I never knew is how did you get or decide to have your wedding at the MCBA? Was it Fall Con at the time?
Yes.
Yeah, because that was a 2-day show in the fall. And I said, was it Nick? And she goes, well, and she started, and Terrence Grief gave her such a wonderful, hey, guys, gather around. Lisa's going to tell us a story. And then, here's Lisa. And she started telling the story that they were together. They had a home. They were kind of getting to the point like they were, knew they were going to be with each other. And then Lisa, as want to do, you see somebody you haven't seen before, and she had to break off the story. But by the time she came back, everybody had broken off in own little groups. She never finished the story. So I think I'm going to get a hold of her somehow, and either in writing or maybe say, hey, would you come on the podcast and tell us the story, how you guys got married in the grandstand at FallCon? Because it was a lot of fun. But yeah, I told Mike's parents, yeah, I was there, but you know, I was there for Lisa and Mike. I didn't know the parents. You know, I remember Terrence as the flower girl. And he's like, oh, yeah, it wasn't the best maid. It was a flower girl. How could I forget? Because I didn't find a picture of you dancing down the aisle doing flowers. I know Brian Wilson and his band played. So one side, when you walked in, he had a couple of his statues there. And I had to laugh because somebody, it was the Dark Knight statue with Batman and the Robin as Carrie, or Carrie as Robin, you know, with the slingshot. And somebody had accidentally removed Robin and couldn't figure out how to put it back. And I just got, amateurs, let me take care of this. There was a Flash statue, a couple pieces of art that might get collected. You know, Lisa tells me their basement looks like a comic shop. So, and I told her, if you need help organizing, getting rid of it, you know, I'm there for you if you need it. And saw a lot of pictures of pre-human planet Mike. Although, like you say, he was a big guy when he's wearing his football gear. And it's always interesting when you see somebody. I'm sure if I ever saw your kid pictures, Corey, I'd be like, oh, not that it'd be like, that was you? Well, duh, of course it is. But it was just interesting to see. You know, you from a portion of life before I knew you. And then on the other side were all the human planet days. A couple made it in that I had, two from the shop, one with me, Scott Liddell, and Mike, which again, that's on my Facebook page if you want to go take a peek at it. Another one where Mike's holding back and enraged Jess Heitland. And of course, at that time, Jess, you know, was about thin as a stick. So quite the juxtaposition between the two. Mike's just holding him off by holding his hand. And then the crazy comic reunion photo, not the one where we posed for the cover, but just the one where that one fun con where all of us were there in one spot and we were able to get a bunch of pictures, which was kind of cool. Anyways, I was talking with Gruber and we were looking at the pictures and I said, all right, we didn't get to the pictures, but some guy comes in and everyone's like, Hey, how you doing? He goes, hey, Joe, pulls his mask down. Cause I didn't recognize him. And I'm trying to figure comic artist, somebody, I know, old customer. I go, hey, how you doing, Pat? Let's go look at pictures. And then we went and we didn't get to that. We started looking at the pictures and then Pat's like, what's up with all the stickers? I said, well, the stickers are in the other room. You go choose one. And they had 2-3 tables full of stickers. Superman, Avengers, My Little Ponies, Harry Potter, whatever. You choose a sticker. And the idea was you go back to the box and you just put one on. As we're looking through it, I said, Pat, I'm going to reenact the day Griff worked at the shop. No one was around us. So, you know, because that was, of course, the big story, you know, it was me, little Mike, big Mike, and we just gassed him out of the place. Oh, evil that day. But then Gruber looks at me like, I said, God, I wish I knew if Griff was coming. And Pat looks at me, what you talking about? He was just right next to you. That was the guy who came walking in and pulled his mask down and said, hello, Joe.
You did not recognize Griff.
Recognize him. And I said, what? You're kidding me. And so I went back and I said, Griff. He said, I was wondering when you're going to recognize me. I was a little hurt. I said, no, it totally blanked on me. I was trying to think comic artist, old customer. Who is this guy? To be fair, he's got a little poundage on him, like we all do. He cut his hair.
What?
He did. His hair is short, much like Butch's is gone. and he's wearing glasses. But as soon as I realized that, oh my gosh. And we just it was like, you know, old friends again, you know, just catching up on stories and relaying the Mike confirmed my story of his first day of work at the help. Big Mike and I, yeah, gave him the hazing. And I'm sure his eyes are still hazing every time he thinks about it. So, and everybody's laughing across. Hey, well, you know, you always got to have a crazy moment at a funeral, you know. So that Cray's still alive and well. It just takes someone I haven't seen in years to do it. Mike does listen to our podcast. So hello, Mike. And I know you demurred at the a couple times, but I really would love to have you come on the show sometime just to tell us your versions of what we've talked about. And to finish up, Mike, little Mike, is the one who left his job. And I said, well, I need somebody, and hired him. So I still think that happened with Mike, because I know Big Mike, I should say, because I know he was working at Target with that other guy that I have his face picture, but I can't remember his name, because they would always bring me in toys that I'd ask about him. And I think one of them brought me in the Godzilla from the Matthew Broderick movie. If you remember when that was going on, they had a moratorium on the toys. They didn't want the toys out before the actual movie, because they didn't want anybody to know what the monster looked like, because they were so excited the way they reimaged him. Yeah, well, they probably should have been, because it, as a monster movie, it was good. It sucked. So one of those guys...
Bat not like. Bat only see five times in theater.
Yeah, only see that. Only five times. That's a stinker in Pat's book. But he, one of those guys brought in the toy, and then I put a box over it, and I said, you know, because we had the wrestling ring set up at the time. I said, you want to ruin the movie? Take a look under the box. About half the people did. But we weren't supposed to have the toy. But we did. Don't worry, folks. Later on, the real Godzilla came I think it was the first time we had a total blowout. It was a loser leave the store match. So, and of course, the fake Godzilla left. Or I should say the real Godzilla won. So a nice tribute to Mike. And like I said, I'm sure I don't know what's going on. I know it's still too soon for Lisa to process everything, but hopefully sometime in the future we can get her on and she can finally give us a definitive story of how her and Mike got married at the con. So I don't know if you got a glass, Tori. One more toast. Let's raise your glasses of your favorite tasty beverage and toast our departed friends, Nick Post, Dave Watkins, Mike Edmondson. And somebody else passed away, too, in the comic industry.
Yes. Joe Sinnott, in his 90s, passed away last week. Joe Sinnott started in art, then went into, basically, he was drafted into World War II. When he came back from World War II, he actually worked in, I believe they say it was a rock quarry.
And I love it. That is amazing.
Ran into somebody who said, hey, there's a lot of jobs in comics right now. And he started freelancing in comics. Back then, he was a penciler. And if you read some of the pre-Code Marvel horror stories, he drew some of those. He worked for other companies as well. And Joe may know this comic. Joe, do you know about the comic called Treasure Chest?
I do.
Can you tell the people about it?
Treasure Chest was I don't know if it was for sale or given away. It was done by a Catholic organization. And I guess you would buy them or get them in church. It ran, I think, late 40s through the 50s. I don't know if it went beyond. Did it go into the 60s?
Yes.
I know.
Yeah, I know that.
How do you know that?
Because Joe Sinnott was one of their main artists until, and he would ink some stuff for Marvel in the early days, But every time Stan said, come on, I need you to do more work, he'd say, no, I'm getting paid more by Treasure Chest. And Stan finally was able to raise the rates enough that he was able to leave in 1965/66, and he worked for Marvel ever since. He also did some work for Archie before he became exclusive to Marvel. He never really had a contract the way they are now where it's exclusive. The contract he had was, you know, you will get this much for this many pages. Kind of like Jack Kirby had a contract. And Kirby's contract, actually, a lot of people say that, oh, when his contract was up, he went to DC. No, his contract was up in 1968. He kept working for Marvel for 2 years as they negotiated. And the sticking point of the negotiation was that Jack wanted more money for the stuff he created. And Martin Goodman said, well, you're crazy. We don't do that. No one does that. Joe Sinnott inked the Fantastic Four during its glory period. He was also one of the best inkers in comics. A lot of people think that an inker just goes over the pencils.
You're just a tracer.
There are some who do that, but there are others who kind of smooth out the pencils. They make them better. And Joe Sinnott was one of those guys. If you look at a Joe Sinnott inked Kirby page versus a Mike Royer inked Kirby page, Royer, his job was just to do it as Kirby drew it. Because Kirby had found out that Vince Coletta was erasing stuff and finally got convinced that, no, you need an inker that puts everything there. So every inker after like 1971, 72 that Jack approved was told, draw what's there. Joe Sinnott, however, understood Kirby's storytelling, so he would smooth out the forced perspective and kind of clean up Jack's, trying to think of the best way to put this, angleism. He would sort of make it work better on the printed page. And if you look at the difference between, you could see, Joe Sinnott was an amazing inker. Another comparison I'll give, Joe, this will probably, when George Perez started, he was doing the Fantastic Four and the Avengers. So next time you have both those out, take a look at the Avengers stuff, which was inked by Vince Coletta, and the Joe Sinnott stuff in the Fantastic Four. You'll see a world of difference. Sinnott retired in the mid-90s, but still worked on projects here and there. He was the inker on the Spider-Man comic strip, pretty much from the mid-90s to when it ended, when Stan passed away. Which is odd because Roy Thomas was the one writing it. Alex Savick was the one penciling it. Joe Sinnott was the one inking it. Stan basically would throw in ideas here and there and edit the script. And they said when Stan passed away that they were going to do reruns for a while and then have a new sort of Marvel-based comic strip, which still has yet to start. But Joe Sinnott, one of the greatest inkers of all time, passed away in his mid-90s.
And I'm proud to say I was one of the 103 backers that pledged his Kickstarter, and I got an oversized edition of the story of Pope John, Roman numerals, the 23rd, which Joe illustrated himself. So, and I actually got a digital download of it that I've yet to actually digitally download. So hopefully it's still available. But,
And if you go onto Facebook and read what the comic professionals are saying, first off, many of them say that they met him after working with them for years because he worked at home. He rarely came into the office, but they also say that, you know, once he started going to conventions and editors talked about how he was the nicest guy in comics, never put up an argument, was always pleasant, always, you know, just had that really happy demeanor. And think about it, you know, he worked in a rock quarry. He was in World War II. You mean I get to sit at home and draw comics? That's a dream job.
I think the modern equivalent is like if I had a job on the phone, I could just stay at home all day and not put on pants. I'm not saying that Joe, you know, was one of the pantsless crowds. Don't get me wrong. He was never at the meetings if he was.
There's one character that I don't think he ever inked. And that would be the first, supposedly, superhero. He wasn't the first. Superman.
Superman. Oh, I thought you were going to say the life of Pope John Paul II, which he did ink.
And was, wasn't that drawn by John, was that drawn by John Romita Sr. or... Oh, I'd have to look that up because I remember that being on the stands.
Hang on a second. I've got the Cray 4000 already cranked up just in case. Let's look it up.
That was actually sold on newsstands after he became Pope. John Paul II was, when he became Pope, it was a really big deal. And me not being Catholic never understood why. Well, why is this Pope, you know, so loved? And the one before him, I never heard about.
Here we go. Life of John Paul II. Which gave one of the best fumetti. I got the life of Pope John Paul II. Did you got copies of Pope John Paul I? I'll have to come back to that.
How about George Ringo? Pope George Ringo.
Ah, Ringo. I'll have to wait because something's up. So often when I go to Atomic Avenue, you get the circle of death where it just decides, you know what? Oh, wait a minute. Here it popped up. Just decides it's not going to work. They're giving credits as writer Steve Grant and artist John Tagalone,
but
doesn't say who the inker was, but they have it. When I was typing in about the other Pope book, The Life of Pope John Paul II popped up. So yeah. I'll go find my copy. We'll open it up and figure it out for good.
Yeah. Stephen Grant, who also wrote the Punisher miniseries and Whisper and, the comic that became the movie Two Guns. That's Stephen Grant.
Oh, just so you know, Treasure Chest of Fun and Fact, the full name, George A. Plum through the Catholic Guild went from 46 to 72.
Oh, wow.
Which is probably where I started picking it up because, like I've bemoaned, there was a story I kept reading about a talking car. It was like a Model T. It wasn't talking, but it was sentient. And, I never found the last part of it, which is what led me to start buying lots of treasure quests, but I never did find the last one. So if you happen to have a treasure quest and you know how
treasure
that story
chest, ended, not treasure chest. Quest.
Treasure, is that what I said? Quest?
Yes.
Well, I don't know. That's not very super of me, man.
Yeah, I was trying to do a transition to us, our theme for this week.
And I was trying to keep us from having stories, you know, and questions just hang out there, you know, like we're wont to do and never answer for years and years. But.
Hey, it could be worse, you know.
It's not going to rain today. Well, wait a minute, it might.
Because over on Russell Crap Radio, I think it was 2007, 2008, Blade Braxton said that he had a huge announcement. He still has yet to make the announcement. So, but no, our theme this week, as we like to have a theme, is our Fave Five. It's a Fave Five episode. I love the Fave Fives. Fave Five Superman stories. And I always go from 5 to 1. Joe always wants to subvert things, so I will let Joe go first.
Well, actually, this time I am going to go 5 to 1.
What?
I know, and I had a tough time at this one because there are so many Superman stories, and I had to figure out how am I going to decide which favorite ones. I mean, anything Alan Moore wrote that had Superman in, I loved. Kingdom Come was a Superman story. But I wanted to stick with just stories that were more Superman and not just stories. Well, Superman's in it. And although, like your Kingdom Come, he's really the pivotal point of everything. He's not necessarily the... it's not really... Well, you know what I'm saying. Kingdom Come isn't Kingdom Come without Wonder Woman, without Batman, without the Monkey Men in the background, you know, that type of thing. So I decided because I've been reading a lot of Superman. Superman was one of the last characters I picked up. I started, of course, with Amazing Spider-Man and went through all the Marvel characters. I didn't pick up Fantastic Four because I had read a lot of them from my cousin. And I was like, well, I read those already. I don't need to collect them. And I tried to get into some DC comics. And Superman was one I always wanted to get into because I was well aware, while he's not technically the first superhero, he's probably the best known that kept the genre going. And I always felt a little guilty that, again, this was 78, 79. Those stories just sucked. But there were always bright spots. And so I thought, okay, let's sit back and think, what Superman stories do I know of now that would still catch my imagination? And the first one I'll go to, I want you to go to your collection and dig out Superman 142 with a cover date January 1961. It's got a gaudy pink cover with a dinosaur or something blowing his nose of fire, hitting Clark Kent, burning off his covering, showing the Superman S underneath with Lois Lane standing right next to him. So the moral of that story is, if you're next to the flame dragon from Krypton, don't let him sneeze on you. The story was actually called Lois Lane's Secret Helper. That's not the story that I want to bring your attention to. The second story was Superman Meets Al Capone. And really, it was more a Perry White story. And of course, Al Capone was in there. And someone, probably even Corey, well, I'm sure Corey thinks of fondly. Corey, tell the folks about Tit Anno.
Huh?
Oh, I'm sorry. I said that wrong. Titano.
Oh, Titano. Titano was a, basically, he was an ape that Superman fought, because if you put an ape or a gorilla on the cover, it sold.
The first time it was more of a like a regular gorilla with a human head or vice versa, whatever. But then they decided to make him King Kong sized, and to make him actually a threat to Superman, he had kryptonite vision. Well, what happens is Perry White asks Clark Kent to get Superman to time travel because they're writing a story about Titanos. Titano. Well, Titano's height. See, they had apostrophe S on that, and that's what threw me how to say it. So Clark changes into Superman, travels back in time, figures out his height. But as he's getting ready to take off, Titano sees Superman and hits him with his kryptonite vision. And Superman finds that the kryptonite affects his ability to travel through time. And he lands in 1871, 1893. And then he lands again in 1920 and decides to hang until the kryptonite wears off so he can make it back to the 1960s. What he does, he finds he's in Chicago. He finds out that Al Capone's on the loose. And he happens upon a young Perry White, who is a shoeshine boy, is trying to convince the owner of the Chicago Journal to give the boy a job if he can bring him a sensational scoop. I need a scoop. Flash scoop. So, wanting to avoid the possibility that Perry may remember any potential meeting, Superman disguises himself, takes off his glasses, gives him a little smudgy birthmark on his face, and calls him. He gets mistaken for Touch Vincent, a local thug. And from there, Superman helps Perry get his first scoop. You know, he's able to use as Vince. You know, Superman powers hidden as Vince, because, you know, Vince is asked to kill a police officer that's been, you know, getting in Capone's face. And Superman uses his superpowers to make it look like the police officer's gunned down. He uses his X-ray vision to melt the bullets. You know, just fun things to do. You know, this was the modern age soup. He could travel through time. He could do whatever he wants. And it's always interesting because it's one of the stories of Superman where you have to depower him in order to make it fun. And this little story I always thought was fun just because he's out of time. He's stuck in the 20s. He's running to somebody he knows. He's going to try to help him, but he can't. he has to kind of hide himself without, because he doesn't want Perry to later remember him. And of course, when they do get back to the present, once the kryptonite beam's worn off, Perry shows off his first headline about a mysterious, untouchable man that foiled Capone's mobs. It's just one of those stories that if I had a chance to do reprints, I would call this Superman Done Right. This is how you could have taken the superpower Superman and make it a real fun, believable story. There's been other ones like that, especially like in DC Comics Presents. I think he went back in time and met Sergeant Rock. And I forget why he was in trouble there, but there was, he had amnesia and he later on, he realized what he had done is inadvertently sent Sergeant Rock into a ambush. So he had to go there. He let himself, great scene. He lets himself get captured and then the, Nazis start torturing him and, they can't, they start shooting bullets, but hey, you think I'm tough? Sergeant Rock's even tougher. And then, of course, he has to play dead because, you know, Sergeant Rock, when he finally does get there and the Nazis are all gone, he's like, oh, man, I can't believe they, those Nazis have a way of killing you without leaving a mark. Well, you know, he just uses super strength to play dead. And then as Sergeant Rock buried him and they're walking away, he Soup climbs out of his grave and flies back to our time. So different type of time travel stories, which I love. This one stuck with me for the longest time. I don't have the issue anymore, but it's just one of those stories that if I were to ever bring Superman back, I would figure some way to redo this story in a modern setting, because I'm pretty sure 99% of you out there have probably never heard of this one. I don't have any creator credits, unfortunately, but that's how Superman met Al Capone. Corey?
My number five is The Man of Steel by John Byrne. Before Man of Steel, Julie Schwartz was the editor of Superman, and Julie's stuff was what it was. He very much was an old school editor, and he liked kind of the each Superman story to kind of be a short story with a hook. There were some stories that I really liked under Julie Schwartz when Marv Wolfman and Gil Kane were working on Superman. I liked that. I liked some of the stories in DC Comics Presents, but for the most part, Superman stories were very gimmicky, very plot driven. So it would almost be, I wouldn't say, oh, I want all Superman. It would be, okay, who's working on that one? All right, I'll get that. And one of the things to remember is Julie Schwartz hired Alan Moore to do Superman stories. And we'll talk about that at some point during this episode, I do believe. But Man of Steel was, okay, crisis has happened. We're going to kind of reboot Superman. And even though I disagreed with a lot of the stuff Byrne did later on Superman, Man of Steel was really the best sort of updating of Superman we've ever seen. It grabbed, now he didn't work on it alone. I want to remind everybody that the Lex Luthor as a businessman was a Marv Wolfman idea. But he basically sort of revamped Superman, toned his powers down a lot, got rid of Ma and Pa Kent dying, reintroduced Superman to the DC Universe as sort of a reset button back when they didn't do reset buttons very often. I've reread it recently, and it really holds up because each issue focuses on a different part of Superman's life. This issue focuses on him working at the Daily Planet. This issue focuses on Lois Lane. This issue focuses on Lex Luthor. And as a six-issue miniseries, it really did a great job of clearing away a lot of the crap that had accumulated on Superman over the previous 50 years. And the story still holds up. Byrne's art was inked by Dick Giordano, who really understood how to make Byrne's art shine. And Byrne was a very popular artist, But by this point, he was getting a lot of shortcuts because he was drawing so much. He'd learned a lot of shortcuts that were becoming more and more glaring. Dick Giordano, who's worked with everybody, smoothed that out, made the stuff look fantastic. And for all of the work they've done on Superman since, this reboot is still kind of stuck. The ideas that were put forth in this are still there. And it hangs together as a fantastic story. So Man of Steel, my number five. Joe, what's your number four?
Oh, I remember that one because that was back in Pat and mine's collector days where we would buy comics for investment and we went super duper 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 heavy in that. Pat may still have them. I remember buying, you know, he would come to cons and he still had packs of Man of Steel that he was selling. I do not know the original issue. Well, actually, hang on a second. Blah, 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 blah. The Midnight Murder Show. And this is Superman in the 70s. And I'm trying to find if they, I'm reading this out of the Best of Superman or Best of DC Blue Ribbon Digest Superman, Volume 1. This run, what we've talked about in the past, were in digest form for the longest time. DC would take the best of their Superman stories. In this case, we got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stories, including one that almost made the cut, The Death of Superman, not the Dan Jurgens epic that you know, we all know and love. So, but this is in the 70s. This is when, who's the guy who bought the Daily Planet?
Morgan Edge.
And whatever
originally was a minion of Darkseid,
which kind of disappeared.
Well, after Kirby left the Jimmy Olsen, they sort of retconned it that the real Morgan Edge had been kidnapped by Desaad, and Superman found the real Morgan Edge, and the Morgan Edge, who was basically the evil bad guy, was discovered to be created in the DNA alien lab. So he was a clone.
Speaking of kidnap, that's what this story deals with. The Midnight Murder Show. And I do have credits on this one. Kerry Bates wrote it. Kurt Swan and oh man, is that smudged? Kampfenberger? Schaffenberger.
Kurt, yeah, yeah. Schaffenberger.
Yep, yep. They did the art. Now, one of the guys who liked to bully Clark Kent was the sports announcer of the TV station, Steve Lombard. I should also say that Clark Kent no longer worked for the newspaper, but he was the anchor of with Lana Lane what was the
WGBS?
Thank you, WGBS. Well, what happened was Steve Lombard is hosting their version of their Tonight Show. They call it the Midnight Show, starring Johnny Nevada. Filling in for Johnny tonight is surprise guest host, star sportscaster and super quarterback, Steve Lombard. And here's Steve. Yeah, I wonder who they're doing that over. I want to tell you folks how hot it is in Metropolis today. How hot was it? Oh, well, meanwhile, in back, you've got four guests, including Clark Kent, because they want Clark on there. They're saying that Johnny's on vacation, but he isn't. What had happened, he was kidnapped, and the kidnappers left a ransom note saying, you know, if we don't get this, our money by a certain time, we're going to kill Johnny. And what's happened is during the story, we see some flashbacks where Superman is trying to find clues as to where Johnny's hiding. A lot of them end up going nowhere, like he ends up scaring the heck out of a transient bum because for some reason they find a fellow fitting one of the kidnappers' description in a junkyard, and it just so happens there's a trailer that has a lead-based paint, again, to thwart Superman. And, of course, we have a little editor note. Superman's X-ray can penetrate any substance except lead. So, And which, you know, is true. That's part of my job at TSA. If you got lead in your bag, we're not going to be able to see through it. That's how you get yourself a bag check, folks. But back to the story. So Superman tunnels in from below and scares the living hell out of a bum. And he, as the time goes on, Superman's getting kind of desperate because he's not quite sure what's going to happen, because he's no closer to getting to find out where the kidnappers have Johnny Nevada. And all of a sudden, before we bring out Mr. Charisma himself, Clark Kent, this is Steve talking. I've just been told we have a super guest star in the wing. So what do you think? We bring him on. Superman. And Superman comes out. Boy, Johnny's going to be sorry he missed it. Steve, what would I... Superman goes, what would you say if I told you Johnny Nevada's on stage with you right now? Well, you play that back for me, Superman? And Superman reaches down and says, I'm going to show you the secret identity of Superman. Pulls off and underneath, it's Johnny Nevada. You owe us an explanation, Johnny. Well, it's like this, Steve. Superman and I agreed to exchange identities for a day. Now, meanwhile, at the kidnap place, the thugs are watching this, looking at the bound Johnny Nevada, saying, does you mean that we kidnapped? It's Superman. Oh, yeah. Well, how did he let us nab us? How did he let us nab him and tie him up? I'm not good at 70s mobster talk. So anyways,
no, there were no 70s mobsters who talked like they did in Superman comics.
I know. So meanwhile, the TV goes on and there's Steve and Superman. Ever since last night, I've been posing as him and he's been masquerading him as me. But the switcheroo wasn't my idea. Superman insisted on it. He wouldn't explain why. So the thugs are busy like, I smell a setup, some dirty trick. And I'm going to prove to you. Here's where I put an end to my own midnight show. And in a wonderful two-page spread, you see the guns in front of the TV screen click, and you, in very, very slow motion, kabam! The next panel, Steve is talking to an empty chair. Right, Johnny? What? He vanished. And now we see a split panel going down the page. One panel is with Johnny tied up as the bullet's coming for him. The other is Superman streaking through Metropolis sky. Yes, he did vanish on his way out of the building, the Galaxy Building, moving so fast he's a blur. No human eye could perceive. Moving so fast, the heat of air friction melts away the Johnny Nevada mask he's wearing, while his super sensitive hearing shuts out all other noise and concentrates on one sound he expected to hear. The distinctive click of a Magnum 44 trigger mechanism, a sound Superman follows to his source. And now onto the next page. And as he proves beyond a shadow of a doubt, bursting through the wall, catching the bullet inches from Johnny's head, that Superman truly is faster than a speeding bullet. The thugs, of course, are like, what happened? That's impossible. With one quick slap, they're out. Superman takes Johnny away. And meanwhile, Steve's left to say, what do you say we bring out Clark Kent? Psst. What do you mean Clark's gone? There's still 8 minutes airtime to fill. How am I going to fill it? It's your call, quarterback. Carry it. And as Steve's fumbling through jokes, it was hot in Metropolis today. Steve's thinking, I can't believe it. For once, Kent's made a jerk out of me before I could make a jerk out of him. The story pivots on those two pages that Superman is indeed faster than a human bullet and how he's able to solve this particular mystery without any other assistance. The fact that he could just listen so carefully and bam, go get it. We see this in other stories. There's a Rick Veitch where Swamp Thing is attacking Metropolis and he's trying to get to Lex Luthor because early on Lex Luthor had done something to him which caused him to be disintegrated. I think it was when he attacked Gotham. But every attack that Swamp Thing tries, Superman is there to thwart him. And he has one where he's just a little pollen of air floating on the dust. And all you see is as he's floating there, you see Superman coming towards you and his hand getting bigger and bigger. And he spotted that. Of course, in the Swamp Thing story earlier that Alan Moore wrote, he makes a comment to Firestorm when they're trying to figure out that there's too much oxygen in the atmosphere that we have to I could tell you how many molecules you are if you want. I can count them. You know, trying to tell Firestorm that, yeah, you can't switch molecules that fast. There's way too many of them. So, again, using Superman's power to a degree, you just realize just how super the pre-crisis Superman is. And, of course, in the next page is even better because there's a quick two-part story where Lois Lane falls out of the window. Eek! Great Scott! Lois tripped and fell out of the window. No time to change in my Superman costume. She flies down. He catches her. Lois is like, aha! I always thought Superman was Clark Kent. That's why I only pretended to fall out the window. Last panel. Say, Clark, where is Lois? Lois? Eh, she fell out the window.
That was actually a reprint from Plop.
Yeah, yeah. It, that's what was fun with this story because they this book is fantastic. The best of DC. And they had so many other stories in there that almost made the top 10. But again, this is just one of those instances that always sticks in my mind. I don't know if they've ever done that with current Superman. But, you know, if I were to write Superman, I would be mining these old stories for elements and just things because nobody's seen this. I mean, this is when the, well, let's see, when the heck did I buy this? 79 is when I bought this. So that's a number of years ago. And this, the story itself, probably 1973 or 74. So look it up. The Midnight Murder Show. Corey?
My number four is an Alan Moore story that was in a Superman annual. And I believe it's even been adapted into an animated movie. But I didn't keep up with the Superman animated movies. It is For the Man Who Has Everything by Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons before they did Watchmen. We start with Superman married to a woman whose initials, of course, are LL, and his son on Krypton. And his father is a disgraced scientist who had claimed that Krypton was going to explode years ago. And when it didn't, he was removed from the Science Council. And as the story goes on, we see basically Clark Kent as kind of just a regular guy on Krypton. Well, not Clark Kent. Kal-El, as just a regular guy on Krypton with a loving wife and a son. And there are problems starting to show up on Krypton. Things are happening that don't seem to make sense. And in what could be my favorite Superman scene ever, Kal-El takes his son out to the desert and says, I love you. I remember your birth. I remember everything about you. You're my world. But I don't think you're real. And we discover that Superman has been attacked by Mongol, who found a plant that attaches to someone, and as it slowly kills them, gives them their heart's desire. And it was on Superman's birthday, and the reason that Superman is able to get free is because Batman, Robin, and Wonder Woman, think good thoughts, Chum, show up at the Fortress of Solitude for his birthday. And when Superman breaks out of it, he attacks Mongol with a fury we haven't seen from Superman because Superman had to wake up from this perfect world that if, you know, the thing that Alan Moore always did so well about Superman is that he's the last son of Krypton. And he is always mourning the fact that he is the last of his race, the last of his kind, the last survivor of Krypton, even though, you know, if you read Superman stories pre-crisis, it's almost like everybody survived somehow. But you've got Alan Moore telling this deep, rich story in just, it was just an annual. It wasn't a graphic novel. It wasn't a special event. It was just an annual. And Dave Gibbons, pre-Watchmen, but still with that level of detail and level of artistry that elevates the story above just a throwaway annual. Alan Moore gets these characters so well, even in little throwaway lines. And the thing about Alan Moore is he may say, oh, superhero comics, I don't want anything to do with them, blah, blah, blah. He has a deep abiding love of Superman. And it truly shows in this story. It's been reprinted bajillions of times. And it's a story that, even though it's, over 30 years old? Yeah, it's over 30 years old. I could still go back and read it, and it feels fresh, and it feels new. And it's not, even though it uses Superman's past, it's not bogged down by continuity. You don't need to know anything other than Superman is the last son of Krypton. That's all you need to know for the story to work. Joe,
I'll even point out, and does the Strode know, and I know you do, when, what was Wonder Woman's gift to Superman?
Wasn't it a special rose that she had created, or was that what Batman gave?
That's what Batman gave.
Then I don't remember.
Wonder Woman gave him a replica of the lost city of Kandor.
Oh, that's right.
And it was to the point where I think, I'd have to read the story, but I think it was so detailed he could use his vision. And Superman looked at it and goes, well, and then he disappeared quick, moved what looked like the Bottle City of Kandor, and then came back to say, that's great. Why did he do that?
Because the Bottle City of Kandor had been either destroyed or was gone, and he had a different replica of it already.
Wrong.
Oh.
You're right in the fact that the city was restored in a story where he brought it to a planet, and because the Kandors chose this planet, and he was able to finally use whatever science and make everything grow. But what happened was all the buildings disintegrated, and Superman was in angst. And I don't recall if Supergirl was in the story or not, but they have to get Superman off the planet because this planet phases in and out of their reality. And they knew if Superman knew that, he would go with them. But then they were thankful that Superman finally kept his promise and got it going. Later on, what happened is he ended up saving a group of people whose natural appearance was to be the size of people in the city of Kandor. And that's how they lived. And Superman kept them to keep them safe. And they were perfect. I mean, he had no angst to try to get these people back home because they were home. They were just on it. And he quickly hid that in order so that Wonder Woman didn't realize, you know, whatever. Again, yeah. Who cares? I care because I read the two stories and I think it's cool. It's a nice little thing that, Superman has that. But for anybody else, it's more detail than you need to know to enjoy the story. It's just one of those things that certain writers, and I'll mention one of them when we get to Freaking and Geeking, they just know how to do this. And Alan Moore was one of them. He could just, he was aware of it. It's not going to stop the story. There was no need to put a footnote. Superman's hiding this because blah, blah, blah. If you knew it, you knew something no one else did. If you didn't, well, okay, Carrie, I felt bad because I kind of swerved you. Let's see. Does the Strode know? Put on your, does the Strode know? What was Mongol's first appearance?
That was in, I don't remember the issue number, but it was an issue of DC Comics Presents in a story written and drawn by Jim Starlin with Superman and Green Lantern teaming up. And I also believe, wasn't that the New Teen Titans preview, 16-page preview issue?
You get 5 cents for that because, yes, Jim Starlin did do the DC Comics Presents number 26, which if you have it, guides over $300 because it is the first appearance of the New Teen Titans. And that story itself almost made my day because it had, one of those scenes that I love because when Superman's going against someone who stole Green Lantern's ring, and I don't believe was Mongol, at least not according to Atomic Avenue. But when Superman goes up against it, Green Lantern's, I don't know how he's going to stop, and you hear, boom! And Superman comes back, hey, if I put my will to it, not even one of these things will stop, as he casually tosses the ring back to Green Lantern. The very next issue, number 27, we meet Mongol. Oh, that's okay. His first appearance. And now you got me thinking, because I don't have a number 26. That may be, maybe he had something to do with it. But it's serendipitous that you chose Alan Moore, because I chose the next three issues of the DC Comics Presents, because it's a three-parter. DC Comics Presents 27, 28, 29. Now, DC Comics Presents was to Superman what Brave and Bold was to eventually be Batman. Just Superman teaming up with various people and having an adventure. Of course, some of the funner ones were Ambush Bug way up a little bit farther, but that's not who I'm going for.
I love Ambush Bug so much.
And believe me, those stories were close on the list. But I've had several copies of this, because every time I run across them, up until recently, they've been super cheap, and I just pick them up at the dollar bins. But now, as people realize Mongol has become a bigger deal in the DC universe, people say, hey, that's his first appearance. So now that first issue can be as high, anywhere from $13 to $50, depending on the shape and who you're buying it from. The three-part story basically starts because Mongol kidnaps... Oh, what the hell? I'll open the issue and take a look, because it's been a while since I've read these. But he kidnaps probably the big three, Jimmy Olsen, Lois Lane, and Perry White. And he holds them so that if Superman has to do his bidding, Superman being Superman's thinking, I will. I'm sorry, it wasn't. Well, I'm not going to figure out. It wasn't Perry White, but it's definitely Lois Lane and Jimmy Olsen. I don't know who the third person is. Maybe it was Steve. But Mongol basically kidnapped three people to get Superman to seek a key, a very precious key carved from the most delicate crystal located in an isolated crypt. Because what he did is he took his three friends and was holding them hostage. And yeah, it was Steve Lombard. So Superman goes, and of course it happens to be, let's see, last at a star system, unimaginable distance. So it's somewhere far, far away. Superman gets there, finds the crypt, starts walking in, and who's the first person to try to stop him? Well, if you looked at the cover, you'd realize Manhunter from Mars, who at this time wasn't seen a lot because he had taken off into space to search for his people. Martian Manhunter explains to him that this key belonged to a race of beings called Warzoons, and what they had done is made this impossibly huge thing called Warworld. What happened is in order to make Warworld work, someone had to strap into it and use their life essence. And eventually, everybody in this race died off. And another group called the Largas, there's not going to be a test on this, so don't worry about it. They discover the threat that Warworld has. And what they do is they reprogram the satellite defenses to prevent anyone from setting on Warworld using, and it's all set to this crystal key that Superman sent to get. And so Martian Manhunter is telling him, see, you cannot have the key. Superman says, well, I understand your position, John. I sympathize, but you forget you're talking to. I'm Superman. And, of course, the obligatory fight scene breaks out with a quick one-page ad for Batman versus League of Assassins, which gets solved due to a delicious bite of Hostess Twinkie Cakes. Oh, I love how you get into a story in these comics and something just pulls you right out of it. John was ready for in case even Superman came, because they were covered in kryptonite, but Superman overcomes him. And of course, with a ring of fire, stops John from even getting in there, gets the key. And there's something to remember about Mongol at this point. He is physically stronger than Superman, and he hands Superman his ass and takes off with the key. And Superman, you know, he gets admonished by John saying, you've just released a danger into the galaxy that you don't understand. He says, well, I'm going to take care of it. Next issue, he calls his cousin, Supergirl, and they go against a menace called Mongol. So in outer space, they go and they spot Warworld. Now, as they're looking at it, they're a couple of light years away. They see, there it is. It's about to pass in front of that white swarf. And Great Rayo, it's not possible. Nothing artificial could be that huge. Warworld passes behind the star. That's how freaking big this is. So they decide to do a little reconnaissance. Using their supervision, they find Mongol. He's at the grave of the last person that died in... And Mongol basically turns and Supergirl goes, "Wait, Superman, wait, take a look behind him. You mean that building? No, behind that. I don't understand. All I see are buildings." "You're still taking a narrow view. Look further. Study the skyscape behind all the buildings and see what it is." It's a mile-long missile. He says, "That's the trouble with supervision, Kara. Sometimes you get so involved with microscopic details, you miss the big picture." Mongo basically, you know, he activates Warworld in his own, you know, type. And while Supergirl takes off, Mongo fires a missile. And as Superman's standing there, all you see is this missile getting bigger and bigger and bigger. He goes, "I've faced a lot of weapons in my time, from Brainiac Shrinkway to Luthor's seemingly entering arsenal. But comparing them to Warworld is like comparing them the first club to an atomic bomb. What if I'm over my head this time? What if I told Kara earlier is true? This missile can kill me." It explodes, taking out an entire solar system. Well, small planetoids, nobody in it. As Kara's looking for Superman, she finds him dazed. They look behind him just in time to see two more missiles coming at him, but this time they're able to fly away. Mongol is enraged, starts sending missiles at them left and right, but the power becomes too much. And eventually Mongol passes out because he has a massive cerebral hemorrhage. Unfortunately, Warworld is now on its automatic and is just firing rays and missiles at anything in front of it. Supergirl goes light years away. She thinks she's far enough away. She does a U-turn and goes as fast as she can, as quick as she can, through the heart of Warworld, disabling it, which allows Superman to land. And by that time, he sees Mongol's escaped. Warworld explodes because Superman redirects the satellites onto itself. Then he's like, "Where is Supergirl?" Which leads to the final part, Superman versus the Spectre. Now, this is old school Spectre. I think that he's a cosmic entity, only showed up when he's needed. He wasn't active as a superhero. And, of course, you get the recap as Silver and Bronze Age comics I want to do. So this was your first issue picked up. You could. And he triangulates where Supergirl went, and he takes off faster than he ever did. And he breaks the bounds of infinity. And he's like, "This is impossible. Supergirl couldn't. I have to return." And then he spots her up ahead as she's unconscious, and her momentum is keeping him going. And so he tries to speed up, and who stops him? Well, I told you, he's on the cover, the Spectre. And what happens is as not so much a battle physically, because there's no way Superman's going to do the Spectre, but he eventually, Superman realizes that no matter what he does, he's just not going to be able to save some people. And Spectre brings him back. You know, Superman tries to save Krypton. He's unable to. He tries to save his father. He's not able to. The Grim Reaper, Superman can't defeat the Grim Reaper. And so finally, Spectre says, "You have to control him, your evil side." And as the shades of Superman 4, the evil Superman is choking out our hero. "How can I stop him, Spectre? There's only one way, friend. You must open your eyes and see." And finally, Superman understands. He's been thinking with his heart instead of his head. He asks forgiveness from the Spectre, and then a voice comes in script art, "And admitting your foolishness is the first step on the path to true wisdom, my son." And Superman's shocked, but Spectre's like, "Don't be alarmed. It's merely the voice of him I serve." And he finally says, "What about Kara? You have to help me save my cousin." Spectre says, "All you ever had to do was ask." Supergirl appears in Spectre's arm. He passes them over to Superman, and then they take off because they have a long rode home and Supergirl has been passed out, doesn't know the end of it. A very, very humble story. Superman starts off all blustering. I mean, he blows past Martian Manhunter, endangering the universe. He realizes he's met his match in Warworld. And then, of course, just arrogantly goes after Spectre and basically gets his super ass handed to him. But then he realizes just something he's forgotten about himself, his heart. A brilliant three-part story. As Corey said, I'll throw out the credits. Len Wein, Bob Rosansky, Jim Starlin, Romeo
Tanghal.
Tanghal, thank you. Sometimes
who inked a lot of the early New Teen Titans.
And in the issue 28 was Mike Teffenberger and Gil Kane. Again, this they might have inked over Jim Starlin. And in 29 with the Spectre, Bob Rosansky and Alex Savuk.
Earlier tonight.
Yeah. Again, a three-issue series. Now it's probably expensive. I have no idea. But this was the first appearance of Mongol. Mongol kept appearing in all sorts of DC Comics Presents all the way up until the final run, his final appearance in the pre-Crisis universe, the story that Corey talked about. That was an Action Annual, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anytime, and I just, you know, I have all the appearances that Mongol did. And every time he showed up, you know it was going to be something, because toe-to-toe, Superman could not defeat Mongol. It just, that was it. Which is why it was so powerful in the DC Comics, or the action that you mentioned earlier, how Mongol finally gets defeated. But we're not going to give away everything, except maybe what's Corey's next pick?
My number three is a miniseries, 12-part miniseries, that was part of the ill-fated DC All-Stars line.
Okay.
All-Star Batman and Robin. All-Star Wonder Woman by Adam Hughes. But there was one that got completed, and that is All-Star Superman by Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely. And it's funny how John Byrne, who did the revamp on Man of Steel, went on and on and on and on and on and on and on about how much he hated this story. How much he hated the art. How much he hated the story. How much he hated that they brought back all the Silver Age stuff. He just, if you've ever gone to the John Byrne forum, which I do not recommend, because you'll leave that forum thinking that, wow, why did I ever like John Byrne? He's a jerk. This is a story where Lex Luthor gets his final revenge and is able to poison Superman. But you don't realize it for a while. Superman has 12 issues, basically, to live. And this is a celebration of Superman as the Silver Age super science hero who understands science and uses all sorts of science gimmickry and time travel and everything like that. For all the people who said that Grant Morrison writes weird stuff just to be weird, if you read this, you'll understand. No, he's bringing back all these Silver Age ideas with a modern sensibility. What was it? Who are the two people who are fighting over Lois Lane? Hercules and
Atlas.
Atlas.
Yeah.
In one issue, which is very much the type of stuff they did in the Silver Age. It's been adapted to an animated movie as well. By Dwayne McDuffie, actually wrote the adaptation. It's a good adaptation, but go and read the comic because Frank Quitely's art is beautiful. Grant Morrison's story is a love letter to Superman of the 60s and 50s, using all of the weird science ideas and how Superman uses his death to save the world again. And I'm not spoiling it by saying that Superman dies in it, because that's the whole point of the story. Superman knows he's going to die, so how can he set Earth and the people he cares about up for when he's gone? Just a fantastic story. Joe has the absolute. I actually got it for for him before he started getting stuff from DCB Service.
Yes.
It's also out as a hardcover, as a trade paperback. Just a fantastic Superman story that explores that idea of where John Byrne brought Superman down to Earth to make him more relatable. Grant Morrison did the opposite and lifted him up to, this is a being beyond us, and makes it relatable for that reason, that even though he's beyond us, he still is connected. There are many different phases of Superman. There's Superman as, you know, the wish fulfillment. There's Superman as the last son of Krypton. There's Superman as the best of us. But there's also Superman as this godlike mythical being. And this goes whole hog into that in a way that no one else has really done. And it's a fantastic, fantastic story. Believe it or not, it would be higher if not for the two other stories that I have. So, Joe, what's your number two?
I pull out my actual copy, the all-new collector edition, C-58, Superman versus Shazam, the Man of Steel against the world's mightiest mortal, in a 72-page super action novel, When Earths Collide. A tale so titanic only these people could tell it. Jerry Conway, Rick Buckler, Dick Giordano. Gary's the writer, the other two are the artists. And this, for me, was a fanboy's dream come true. I love Shazam. It could be because of the old TV show that was on in the 70s. It could be because I actually met CC Beck and had him autograph one of the copies of Shazam number one. I was able to pick up oodles of cheap Golden Age before they started to go crazy expensive. So I knew who the characters were. I understood the multiple Earths. He was hanging on Earth S. I loved the idea of the Superman family. And of course, I had four color crushes on both Supergirl and Mary Marvel. So to see these two fight in a deluxe tabloid size was even better. The synopsis of the story, basically, a Man of Steel versus World Mightiest Mortal, collecting. I'm trying to think of what. Let me just take a peek in here. Let's see. Who is the bad guy? His name is yeah, I can really. They must have had fun figuring out. I am Quamir. I can't even say it without Googling my head. First thing he does is to bring back Black Adams and the. Did that sand creature from Neil Adams ever have a name?
No.
Well, he's back.
And it wasn't Neil Adams. It was Denny O'Neill and Kurt Swan.
Oh, that's right. I'm thinking someone else. But so he comes back. And, of course, Black Adam wants no part of it and gets humbled right away. But what this wizard wants to do is he wants to use the destruction of Earth S and Earth 1 to bring back his people. Because they're haunting him because he inadvertently destroyed it. And from there, you find that... I'm sorry. I'm going to have a tough time because I'm looking through this going, oh, I think I'll just shut up and read and you guys can listen to me switch pages and go, ooh, ah. But through doppelgangers, makes it look like Black Adam's disguise as Shazam. He hits Superman with a judgment ray after, you know, the obligatory fight. And Superman's going nuts. He goes, Captain Marvel did this. He dared to attack me. Now I'll make him pay. Supergirl, who came because she saw the battle. What? I'll kill him as he flies out. And she is utterly freaked. Meanwhile, on Earth S, we see a similar scene where Super Shazam, and I think, let's see, blah, blah, blah. They could call him Captain Marvel then, but for trademark purposes, they had to use Shazam. And Mary are on a bridge busy saving. And later on, in a little bit of continuity, there's Billy sitting in a malt shop with Sissy, his girlfriend, and Billy's thinking, wait a minute, that can't be him. He should be on Earth One. He goes out, says the magic word, and of course, our sand creature is happy because he's drawn him out. And the first thing that happens is he clobbers Captain Marvel. And, you know, we're going to battle to the death. And eventually he's able to hit him with the Judgment Ray. And so now Captain Marvel is, it was Superman. Superman did this to me. Mary's like, you're kidding me. Would you shut up? How dare that super rat attack me? I don't want anyone to treat me like he did. I'm going to Earth One and give that guy a walloping. In between the storylines, we go back to Quamere, and he's telling the story of how he killed his people, why he's haunted, how his plan's going to do it. And then, of course, the main event. Oh, my God, a two-page spread right in the center of the book. Superman versus Captain Marvel. They're both standing at each other, fists rage and rage. Captain Marvel, this time I won't give you a chance to harm innocent bystanders. We're going to fight, and you're going to fight me alone. I'm going to smash you like the insect you are. Captain Marvel, Superman, you wanted to fight, mister, you got it. There's going to be any smashing to be done. It's going to be me starting now. And Mary Marvel is just, I can't believe it. These guys are talking like street punks. And as they fight, it's, you know, they're pretty evenly matched. But before Mary Marvel can do anything, Supergirl gets involved. And of course, they do. This is the first meeting of these two because they know of each other. They've never met. And they start to make notes saying, well, who could do this? Well, Mary Marvel figures it out. It had to have been Black Adam from way back in Shazam 28, which, by the way, if you have it, I believe is a $400 plus comic. And then, of course, Supergirl realizes it's a being that came to our dimension from Superman 233. Again, no name on the guy. And they realize while Superman and Shazam fight, they're going to go find out what happens. And Quamere doesn't realize it, that he's got two other super. We see Supergirl throw down with Black Adam. When Mary Marvel catches up to the sand creature, he doesn't fight because he basically is leaving himself on Earth because he's feeling guilty for what he did. And he basically spills the beans on what's going on. Supergirl, meanwhile, is able to get a scepter that Black Adam's using and use the lightning to change him back to his doppelganger. And, of course, he's mortal. The fight, meanwhile, is raging on and on and on. And you know what? I think I'm going to end there because you want to see how this thing ends up. You could probably go find a copy of it somewhere. Let's take a look here. They're kind of expensive, but they've been reprinted time and time again. And what's fun is on the back page, you got a courtroom battle between Superman and Captain Marvel story by E. Nelson Bridwell, who explains, you know, those Golden Age shenanigans that Corey and I have talked about in podcasts past. But this was a fantastic book. The big regret I have, and I've talked about it, is I didn't realize Gary Conway was at one of our cons and never had him autograph this for me. You just got to pay attention, people. But yeah, this to me was fun too. I can't say Superman's my favorite character, but Shazam definitely is. I do have a thing for Supergirl. I've been collecting all of her post-crisis appearances. And, you know, part of the fun of Captain Marvel is that you could believe you with a magic word, you could be him. You didn't have to be rocketed from Krypton to have superpowers and have a lot of money like Batman. But so if you get a chance and you find this sitting on a bin somewhere or you know, one of the reprints that occurs, because I know there's a book out, Superman versus Shazam, which contains, it's only $20 if you can find it. It has a collector edition as well as the DC Comic Presents stories where they fought and also an annual 3 where, Superman and Shazam fought. I mean, I think if I recall right, their first fight was actually in a JLA, Crisis on Earth S. So, you know, it was just one of those things I remember as a kid, because it's like anytime you see these two lock up, you know, it's going to be, there's going to be a run. We got a slobber knocker going on. Corey, what's your next book?
My next is a two-issue story. The first issue is written by Alan Moore, drawn by Kurt Swan, and inked by Murphy Anderson. The second is written by Alan Moore, drawn by Kurt Swan, and inked by George Perez. It was considered the finale of the Bronze Age Superman, and that is Whatever Happened to the Man of Steel. The framing sequence is that a reporter shows up at Lois Lane's house to ask about the end of Superman. How did Superman die? And the two issues tell the story of how Luther and Brainiac teamed up together. Not just the Luther-Brainiac team that we think of, but also that Brainiac took over Lex Luthor. And all of the plans they had to finally destroy Superman, to the point where the Legion of Superheroes shows up because they know this is Superman's last day. There is a twist at the end. Actually, there are two twists at the end. But what this is Alan Moore doing a very loving tribute to the Superman of the Silver Age under Julie Schwartz and Mort Weisinger. Kurt Swan does a fantastic job here. The first issue with longtime inker Murphy Anderson. If you've seen any Superman stories from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know Kurt Swan's art. He and Murphy Anderson worked together so much that they were called Swanderson by fans. This is just a fantastic story that goes through all of the additions to the Superman mythos that were made by Mort Weisinger and Julie Schwartz. It sounds like a very depressing story, but it's a very heart-wrenching story that has a twist ending that will actually give you a smile. It's been reprinted hundreds of times, I think. And what it was, Julie Schwartz just came to Alan Moore and said, write the last Superman story. And Alan Moore, who has a deep love of Superman, puts his all into this. And these were the last two issues of what? Action Comics went away for a few months and came back as a team-up book. Superman ended with issue, wasn't it 424? I think it was 424.
I'll double check while you...
I'm 90% sure it's 424 and Action was 682. Superman's numbering continued after the Man of Steel with Adventures of Superman, but there was a new Superman number one, and everybody thought, oh, this new Superman number one is going to be worth hundreds and thousands of dollars. It's not. But this is just, you can pick up this book. There's a wonderful hardcover edition. One of these days, I wish they would put out an annotated version that actually would... You know, if you want to really wring the money out of the fanboys, throw in reprints of the stories where Alan Moore got the stuff from. But this is, again, this is a story I go back to. It's over 30 years old, and you go back to it over and over because it just, one of the things about Alan Moore's Superman is it's steeped in this nostalgia. Because Superman is a character that when you're a kid, blows you away. It's hard to write a Superman story that appeals to adults because Superman is a character that appeals to kids, not like Uncle Scrooge or even the 40s and 50s Captain Marvel stories, but sort of that, wow, wouldn't it be cool if, wouldn't it be cool if I could fly? Wouldn't it be, everybody would love me if they just knew who I really was inside. Alan Moore captures that in these two issues. And just cements it as one of the best Superman stories ever. And now it's time for Joe to give his number one, as we've been going over, I think we're at 90 minutes now. Yeah, at 90 minutes.
Just for the record, Action Comics was 423 and Superman was 423.
Action, I'm sorry. It's not 423.
Action, Action was, where'd it go? I'm sorry. Superman 423, and then it goes into Action 583.
583, okay.
Yeah.
I was 100 years off.
Oof. Well, you're allowed.
Exactly. 100 issues off.
Corey, have you ever had a holy grail that you had to find
yes.
in comics? I remember some of mine, and I've talked about them on the podcast before. The first What If. What if Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four? And again, now he has. But back then in the 70s, I mean, and I had found the early Spider-Mans from those paperback books I'm always so fondly talking about. So I understand in the first issue, he tried to join the Fantastic Four and left. And this is a what if he had done that? And I had to find that issue. Oh, my God. I went high and low and found it. Had to look for it. Imagine my little brain imploding when I saw an ad for an old comic about Superman versus the Amazing Spider-Man. Holy sweet mama, when the hell did that come out? So I'm in 1978, 79. And I'm like, oh, I came out in 76. I got to find a copy of that. And it took me a few years. Again, this was way before internet. The best you could hope for if you wanted to drop an ad to this weird place, Mile High Comic, that kept advertising ads, you could. But I was able to find one. Superman versus the Amazing Spider-Man in that iconic cover. Again, a super-sized tabloid, 1976. I mean, the creator credits, written by Gary Conway, pencilers Ross Andrew, uncredited Neil Adams, John Romita Sr. doing, Neil did Superman figures, Romita did some Marvel faces, inkers Dick Giordano, Terry Austin, uncredited for background, Bob Wiacek, again, guys who just, I cannot imagine what the hubbub for this would have been, you know, coming up to it. Marvel and DC had co-published the Wizard of Oz comic, but this is the first time their characters met face to face without shadows or wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Squadron Supremes, really JLA, that type of thing. And oh, it was amazing. The continuity takes place on kind of its own Earth because both Superman and Amazing Spider-Man, they don't use any type of cross world thing. They just happen to exist in the same universe and they've never met before.
You know what universe I always called this?
What's that?
Earth dollar sign.
Earth dollar sign. Why not?
That's where all the crossovers took place.
Oh, yeah. And It's a classic setup. Lex Luthor. It starts out Superman, Lex Luthor, and a giant robot, and then we go to New York, and Superman, Mary Jane are at a press expo as a new satellite commsat, and Lex disguises Superman, swoops in, shoots a teleportation ray out of Superman's mask, teleports Lois and Mary Jane away. You have some fun parts where Clark Kent and Peter Parker meet. As this is happening, Peter runs up and Clark Kent, where's the phone booth? Where's the nearest phone booth? Over there. Well, at that time in the 70s, they were just hanging on the wall. They were at the classic phone booths. Superman mistakenly blames Superman for the disappearance of the two women. They begin to fight. They dodge each other's punches. And, of course, in order to juice things up, Luthor fires a gun at Superman, which allows him, via red sun radiation, to negate Superman's invulnerability and let Superman just lay a haystacker right on Superman, which surprises the living hell out of him. Eventually it wears out and Superman breaks his hands against Superman's chest and
Spider-Man breaks his hands against Superman's chest.
Either way, they know they can
go
find
it. You said Superman breaks Superman's hands.
It doesn't matter. They know. They're used to me juxtapositioning people. Heck, for all I know, Superman was married to Mary Jane at this point. But the two heroes realize they've been deceived. They figure out it's Luthor and Doc Ock. They get together. They solve the mystery. They rescue the women. Just a fantastic story. A lot of fun. The only real continuity glitch I have is because Luthor wants to destroy the Earth. And Doc Octopus balks because he's like, I think he says he has family on this planet.
Earth. That's where all my stuff is.
Well, but they ignore the fact that Lex, I don't know if at this time he knew of his sister, Lena Luthor. I kind of thought he did. But again, I wasn't reading stories in 76. All mine was back issue. But maybe he was right, because I always thought they tried to keep Lena's or Lex from knowing he has a sister. But I thought he did know. And so for him to say, I want to destroy the Earth because I don't have anybody here, you know, again, just one of those continuity things that even I got, even though I was reading this as a back issue. You get the scene of Superman rips off two of Dr. Octopus's arms, shatters his eyeglasses. Spider-Man uses psychology to divide the villains. That's what gets Dr. Octopus to realize Luthor's scheme that will destroy the Earth, leaving him with nothing to rule. That was his thing. Doc Octopus actually ends up being the hero because one of his robotic arms destroys the weather machine, stopping the disaster. And Superman then has to take off to stop a giant tidal wave, and he's Superman. He does it. And Spider-Man is left behind to defeat Lex Luthor. And they congratulate themselves. They leave. They take the villains in custody. In an epilogue, Lois and Clark go on a double date with Peter and Mary Jane. So it was just a lot of fun to see these two get together. And then Marvel had their chance a few years later when they did Superman and Spider-Man. And there they fought Dr. Doom and the Parasite. And they had, I think, Wonder Woman made a guest appearance. And
the Hulk.
And the Hulk, yeah. And that actually appealed more to my sensibilities because, again, you hear the little nitpicking I did with continuity. I didn't really have nitpicking like that in the Superman and Spider-Man, because I think Marvel covered the continuity just a little better. It could be because Jim Shooter and Marv Wolfman were writing it. And this started the whole crossover thing where it's like they kept switching either or, led to the Batman Hulk, which was meh, and the eventually X-Men New Teen Titans, which was brilliant. The last folly, of course, was the JLA Avengers, which even I got myself drooling. Now, what was fun about it is the question, like Corey brought up, you know what Earth this was on? Well, there have been some leaking outs of, how would you say it, as to whether or not this is actually a continuity thing, or is it its own Earth? If you remember in What If number one, again, they show Spider-Man about to receive a punch from an off panel Superman, but when you see his sleeve and his fist, there was a, in Mosaic 10, I'm sorry, Mosaic number four in 2017, there's a Spider-Man memory depicting him unleashing a volley of punches against a partially obscured Superman. And then, Corey, do you know what the other scene of Superman versus Amazing Spider-Man, where it appeared?
I don't.
We'll talk about it when we get to Freaking and Geeking.
Oh, okay.
But for me, yeah, that Superman versus Amazing Spider-Man was a, again, another fanboy dream. I mean, you're looking at that cover. They've aped it since. And I just, my 12-year-old mind was imploding until I finally got me a copy of that baby and got to read it. And finding it's going to be tough. They're expensive. The reprints are expensive. The trade paperbacks are out of print. And with DC and Marvel being who they are today, how do we say it, Corey? Money on the table. They're just leaving
license
money on the
table. To print money.
It is. And they just don't want to do it. So I don't know if there's any pirate sites because I don't play that game. But if you can find yourself a copy, you definitely want to read this baby because it's just a world of fun.
There Corey, were a series of trade paperbacks. There were four of them called Crossover Classics that were printed back around the time of Avengers JLA. They're probably fairly expensive, but the four trade paperbacks reprint all of the Marvel DC crossovers except for Marvel versus DC and the Amalgam books.
A quick look on the eBays, $45, $30, $60.
That's not terrible.
Yeah. No, not really, but they're paperbacks. And, you know, again, you've got to compare it to what the cost of the originals are. Some of the originals you may find cheap. The problem with the aforementioned Superman versus Shazam, Superman versus Amazing Spider-Man, is that they're tabloid size. And so they're going to be real hard to find in a decent shape. And again, money on the table, license and print money. Marvel, DC, you steal every other idea Corey and I ever cough up. Why don't you go ahead and steal this one and just reprint these babies? Nobody's listening. Corey, tell the people you're number one.
All I need to do is play this and people will know what it is. That's right, Superman the Motion Picture came out in 1978, gave us Christopher Reeve as Superman, which may have been the best superhero casting ever. Sorry, Robert Downey Jr., but Christopher Reeve was Superman. This distilled everything about Superman. There are flaws in the story. There is goofiness in the story. It's not taken 100% seriously, but it doesn't matter because you watch that movie, you get the essence of Superman. You get everything about the mythos, and Christopher Reeve makes Superman what he should be in the comic. A relatable everyman who, yes, he's got all these powers, but he still can't have what he wants. He wants a normal life. He wants to fit in with humans, but he's always apart from them just a little bit, just off. He's with humans, but he's not one of us. So because he's Superman, he can never really fit in, which is one of there are a number of facets you can use with Superman. My favorite has always been that he's just not one of us. Because everybody at some point feels alone and alienated. And Superman kind of, because it's drama, amps that up to the nth degree. But Christopher Reeve never makes it where Superman becomes emo and mopey. Well, except in Superman 3, but that sucked. But there's always that hint of happiness that's tinged with sadness. And he brought that so perfectly. You've got Lois Lane falling off the Daily Planet building. You've got Lex Luthor in a secret lair. You've got Luthor. You've got Lex Luthor with an evil plan. You've got all of the things. This movie resonated so much. We talk now about how Marvel makes their stuff more and more like the movies. John Byrne's Man of Steel was basically, I love Superman the motion picture so much, I'm turning Superman into that guy. It completely changed how we saw Krypton. It completely changed so many things in the comics. But I dare you to hear, if you saw that movie, I dare you to hear those notes and not get a stirring feeling of, this is what Superman should be. The movies after it, Superman 2 was flawed because they switched directors midstream.
It was sad for me because I never saw Superman. I did see Superman 2 in the theater.
Okay.
So that was my first exposure. But later on, I discovered Superman and I got the Downey cut of the original.
Which really isn't the... The Donner cut of Superman 2 a lot of the stuff at the end of Superman the Motion Picture was supposed to be at the end of Superman 2. It's a fascinating story in how that happened, too. And I could go into that, but we're already at an hour and 45. So I just want to say my favorite Superman story is Superman the Motion Picture. There is not a time I will be flipping through channels and see it's on and don't just stop and watch it unless I have to leave, because it was big budget. It was taken seriously. We talk a lot about the first Batman movie by Tim Burton as the time when, okay, now we're going to get good superhero movies. Well, Superman the Motion Picture did all of those things as well. It's just nobody learned the lesson from it to make more. But when I think Superman, yes, I think the comics. Yes, I think the TV show. But when I think the best Superman, it's Christopher Reeve in Superman the Motion Picture. And when I think the best people on this podcast, I think of these guys, our sponsors. Believe it or not, kids, this here podcast has sponsors. And that sponsor, since day one, is DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best, bar none, web host in the whole known universe. And if you need a website, head on over to DreamHost.com, put in code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, and get $20 off your first year. Now, if you would like to advertise here on any of the Solitaire Rose Network podcasts, you can. Just email me at solitarerosenetwork@gmail.com, subject advertising. Also, head on over to eBay and look for user Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z. That's Joe, Crazy Writer, who's always telling us about the eBay in every episode of Crazy Comics and Stories. If you would like to contact us, you can do so. You can give us a call at 952-856-0519. Leave a message and we'll play it on the show. Or you can send us an email at solitarerosenetwork@gmail.com. Thanks. And there are all sorts of podcasts that happen, but we've got all of these. The Solitaire Rose Podcast Network is filled with all kinds of audio goodness. First, there's Crazy Comics and Stories. It's been going since 2010. It drops every Monday, and it has me, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rap Bastard, and Joe, Crazy Writer, talking comics, shenanigans, and whatever we're freaking and geeking about every Monday morning. It's been going since 2010, and it's available at crazycomics.solitairerose.com. Also on that same feed is the Solitaire Rose Podcast, which is me, again, your charming and delightful old Uncle Rap Bastard, doing interviews, talking about comics, talking about comics history, pretty much talking about whatever I want to talk about. We've also got Solo Joe, where Joe Crazy Writer does a solo podcast, and he hasn't done one in a while, so kick him in the shins to get him started. We also, on that same feed, have Solitaire Rose Series and Review, where we do DVD commentary of older comic book series. That's all at crazycomics.solitairerose.com. I also do a podcast with Wolfie B. Bad at badadvice.solitairerose.com, where we take listener questions and give them bad advice. There's also Novelcast, where I take the novels I've written and turn them into free audiobooks. That's at novels.solitairerose.com. There's also Fantastic Forecast, where myself and Adam Vermillion are going through the entire run of the Fantastic Four, four issues at a time. That's fantasticforecast.solitairerose.com. And if you think that I'm on all of these podcasts, you're wrong. Because Scrabbling Across the West is at scrabbling.solitairerose.com, where musician Dave Coffell and his wife Stephanie travel across America and then sitting down to play Scrabble and talk about the day. That's at Scrabbling Across the West, scrabbling.solitairerose.com. There are always more podcasts at the Solitaire Rose Podcast Network. Be there. Aloha. And now we get to Joe's favorite part of the show. No, not where I go through a list of artists who should draw Supergirl like Terry Dodson.
I thought maybe examining moles on our body.
No, it's Joe. What's going on the eBays?
You tell me, Mr. Strode. I want you to explain to the people what they can expect when they get a package that I send them through the eBays.
I ordered a copy of the 30th anniversary film for the MCBA because I was not at that con. But since I was involved in the beginning of the MCBA, and now the MCBA no longer exists, I thought that, I'd like to have that. Put it with my 25th anniversary pin, which was not a Cloisonne pin, just a regular kind of a plastic pin. And, look, I also have a Legion of Doom pin with it. Cool. But with that was a comic that Joe picked up for me at Walmart a while back. And Target. Was the Target one?
Yeah, you can tell because it was $10 instead of $5.
And he threw that in. And then the invoice was printed on a flyer for the podcast, talking about how we do this podcast and you should listen. And perfectly packaged, by the way. I've gotten, I got two omnibuses from eBay recently. And it's easy to tell that the box they used had been used multiple times. Looked like the box had been stomped on a few times. Thank goodness the omnibuses were wrapped in enough bubble wrap to pack a horse. But the box itself that you sent was a brand new box, easily opened. Everything was secured so that it wouldn't get crushed. I have not written the feedback yet because I haven't been at my home computer for, a week? I've been running around using my laptop and my tablet and everything because, we'll get to that with freaking. But, the feedback will be that it was perfectly packaged and delivered quickly.
Folks, you've heard Corey's testimony, so you know I may be wrong, but you know eBay-wise, I'm always right. Check it out, Crazy, K-R-A-Y-Z. And, of course, as I say every time, if you mention you're a listener of this here show, let me know. I might cut you a deal on something, like those cow comics I mentioned. I read them. They're up on eBay. Did you know they're going for, like, $300 somewhere?
That's amazing to me.
Isn't it crazy? I bought them for $4. And again, I enjoyed reading them, but they're not something I'm going to keep. So and because mine aren't mint, I'm doing mine at a mere $100. Only $100. Help.
Only $100.
Only $100. But I got to buy it now for one of those make an offer deals. And if I know you're from the show, I'm more than willing to deal with you, or I might toss in an extra freebie. Maybe one of those pins Corey mentioned, or maybe let's see, reach over here. Oh, hell no, I'm not giving you my copy of Wicked Warden Elsa or Women's Prison Massacre DVDs. Matter of fact, Chris is gone today. I may end up watching those. Ooh, see, even I sidetracked myself. Crazy on eBay. Come get some.
And now we get to my favorite part of the show. No, not where I end the show, because the gym is finally open. Oh, thank goodness. And they have to keep all the doors open there.
Ooh.
No, it's Freaking and Geeking Joe. What are you freaking on?
Not too much. I'm back at work. We're working. My schedule's changed again. I think this is about... What's weird is that every time I have some time off, my schedule changes. And it's not so much that things are changing in baggage, but there seems to be, and it's not really that more people are flying either, but what they've done, at least at my airport, is they're trying to minimize your wait time so that they don't want you in there any more than you do. And if folks, in all seriousness, if you want things you can do to try to get through a checkpoint quicker, especially if you don't fly a lot, you can jot me a note and I will give you my suggestions. A lot of it has to do with just listen to what they say. If you got a block of cheese, I'll tell you an interesting fact. A block of cheese and a block of C4, the military-grade explosive, they look alike on the X-ray. Take it out of your carry-on luggage. Put it in a tray so that they can look at it and go, oh, it is cheese. It's not somebody trying to sneak C4 through. You got a laptop, even if you're pre-check. Well, pre-check, you can leave your laptop in. Got two laptops? Got three laptops? You might want to take them out because they're hard to look through. all sorts of fun things like that. That little tricks you can get, not only because I worked there, but also because I used to travel way back in the early days of the show. And believe me, I have little complaint. I have a dim view of people. I have trouble with security. It's like I've flown dozens of times and never had a problem. And a lot of it is just not because I don't get special treatment when I fly because I'm TSA. If anything, I might get a little extra treatment because they don't know if I'm running a test bag or anything through. Fortunately, the people at the checkpoint now, I don't know any of them. So I love it when the dogs go, though, especially if I was traveling for on the NDO, because the dogs can smell the uniform. And when they smell the uniform, they think, oh, test, which is why when we do testing on them, we don't wear the uniform or carry the uniform anymore, because they're smart, you know, just like we are. So, yeah, that's anyways, with scheduling, they finally settled on when, and this starts. Oh, where are we now? We are recording on the 28th. So this starts on the 5th. So by the time you all listen to this here podcast, it'll be starting, but I'll be working 2 days a week. And then the following day, 3 days a week, and then two and three and two and three until traffic actually picks up. Well, it's possible, because I realistically don't see traffic ever picking up in a while, because even if the economy miraculously recovers, people are going to have to get their rent paid off, their mortgage, catch up on bills.
And maybe business travel may never recover.
It's now possible.
That they can, you know, where I work, they said no business travel at all. You do it virtually, not just because people are working from home, but because they've spent all this money on, you know, these offices with high-def TVs and high-speed digital connections. And before it was, oh, we need to go, you know, to shake hands and kiss babies. And now it's just, no, we're going to be in our office, do the presentation. And nobody, you know, no businesses want, they want as little contact as possible. So more and more, it's, we have put together these excellent multimedia presentations for new clients. Why, after we've spent hundreds of dollars on that, why would we also want to fly you there just to show them the digital presentation when we could do it just as well, if not better, via Zoom or Microsoft Meeting or something like that? Same for hotels. Hotels, you're going to see a change in hotels because business travel may not recover for years.
Yeah, there's a lot of restaurants that are going under. Retail stores are hanging on. There was even a GoFundMe for our buddy down in Mind's Eye, because he's trying to get caught up with his rent and everything. And so, you know, do what you can. Take care of yourself. And then, of course, we were talking. I think we were talking about it. You know, I've got a sore throat. I feel clammy, feverish. I'm having an allergic reaction to the cat. Or am I? I don't know. I think I am, because I've I don't know if I talked about it on air, but my daughter's cat, he's an older rescue cat, no claws, no teeth, friendly guy, on his terms, as most cats. Occasionally, he just decides he wants to come over and sit on your face, you know. And while it's cute and he's cuddly and he purrs like a son of a bitch, I'm allergic to cats, especially at that type of close contact. And I had an all-out cat attack, and I'm kind of like, well, this is hopefully the end of it, or maybe it pushed me into a cold. I don't think I've been exposed to anybody. But, you know, they're always, you know, every time you're like, oh, I feel kind of warm. COVID! Ah! Oh, well. It's just, it's the times we're in. And every time we do that, I take a drink and I'll toss it to Corey. What are you freaking on?
Man, I've been at the group home a lot.
Regular groupie.
Like I've said, the office job, every day we're asked to do overtime. They actually sent us in to pick up our personal items.
Ooh, that's usually that's bad.
But what it is, it's time for them to bring in people to train them for open enrollment, which usually begins September, October, November, December. So July is when they bring in the temps and start training them. And because they have to social distance, it's okay, we're going to have a desk and then an open desk and a desk and an open desk. So they need this desk spaces. And like I said last week, we have been told we will be working from home for at least the rest of the year. And if I was a betting man, I would bet that it's permanent. That once, you know, you come in as a temp, then after you've shown that you can show up on time and your scores are okay and they actually need you and you can show that you can, you know, work differing schedules. There's all sorts of tests they do that they don't tell the temps, basically, which is why it took me a year to be hired on. There was all this stuff going on in the background. But once they bring you in, they're going to, okay, you've shown that you can be trustworthy. You're working from home. And as long as your scores and your numbers don't go down, you'll work from home for the rest of, you know, however long you're in that job. So I had to pick up my stuff. And it was weird because they gave you like, okay, here are the 3 days this week. You can pick it up between these times. And it's like, oh crap, I'm working the group home all three of those nights. So the one night that I was to pick up my stuff, everything had to, basically the clocks had to run precisely on time. I get done at 5, I drive to the office, I pick that stuff up, then I get to the group home because I have to start there at 6. Well, I get a call at 4:59 from someone who, why don't I have benefits anymore? Well, you're no longer an employee. But I was told that as long as I worked 30 hours a week last year, I would have medical coverage for the rest of this year. That's the law. That's the Affordable Care Act. No, you have to remain an employee. That's not part of the law. So that call went for 15 minutes. And I'm rushing to get there to get my stuff. And the box they used to pack up my stuff, they didn't tape the bottom of it. So I had to pick all that stuff up and figure out how to carry the box with the and I got to the group home at 6:03. If you're there if you're 5 minutes late, you're counted as late. So I made it with 2 minutes to spare. But I've been at the group home a lot, and last night they called and said, we don't need you for the overnight. Because, you know, the person that you were helping out fill in for the two people, their COVID tests came back negative. They didn't tell me these people were be tested for COVID. No, they were just like, oh my God, we need you to work here and it's desperate. We need this and we need this. And I had basically this week, I think Monday night we recorded, right, Joe?
Last week? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I did not have a single night that I wasn't working because, you know, recording the podcast is working, covering wrestling is working. Every other night I was at the group home. And so when they finally called and said, yeah, we're not going to need you tonight. I had just gotten home and I laid down and slept for 2 hours. Then woke up and it's like, I get to stay up late, watch bad movies on a Saturday. Yay. DC is going to be printing their DC solicitation. What is it called? The DC.
Direct Currents, whatever.
Yeah, DC Direct Current or Preview. They're printing it again, Joe.
Yay.
As a poster.
Stupid.
The checklist poster measures 13.25 inches by 10.1875 inches. Will arrive at stores folded, the size of a standard comic book. Readers can fill it in and return it. So, but you have to unfold this poster, checkmark what you want, and give it back to the shop. Then the shop has to open up. And I don't know about most shops, but a poster size thing next to your computer.
I suspect DC Comics is being run by people that don't understand comic books.
I suspect DC Comics is being run by AT&T. And I've had AT&T service before, and they're terrible.
If I may quote Judge Smells from Caddyshack, It sucks.
As I may quote John Oliver, suck it, corporate daddy. That's right. We made fun of you on a show that you own, and you can't do anything about it. Joe, what are you geeking on?
I have read a lot of graphic novels. They have finally lifted the ban on graphic novels because finally there was a couple things going. First of all, about 70% of the shifts weren't enacting the non-reading ban. And of course, that just means the remainder guys who are doing it, acting the ban, were basically just got a lot of disgruntled people working for them. It's kind of like my boss said, you know, it's like I report like, hey, they're not following what you asked. And then their boss gets on his case and he gets mad. And I told him, oh, yeah, you're not going to win because the original guy who came up with this goofy idea is going to come down from the clouds one random day and start yelling at you. Why is everybody reading again? I'll tell you why, because I spend a 10-hour shift. And whereas I used to look at 300 to 500 bags with 20 to 30,000 bags going through the system, I'm now looking at maybe 10 on a big day, maybe 20. And now that we're fully staffed almost, that means instead of 2-3 people each looking at these bags, now I got 8 to 9 people looking at these bags. And I've been telling my friends just, hey, coworkers, because a lot of times I'm the lead, I don't care what you do. You're not allowed to use your personal electronics in your workspace. So just, you know, get off camera and don't fall asleep. And the best way to do it is to read. I personally enjoy listening to music. When I read, sometimes I get so into what I'm reading, I forget that, oh, there's a bag sitting there I need to check out. But be that as it may, I actually have a big stack of graphic novels. Some I've read before, some I haven't, and some I just finished. Like the aforementioned American Comic Book Chronicles, the 1990s, I finally finished up. And again, these are blasts. Even if you don't necessarily care about the minutiae, what's going on, or you think you know what happened, these are worth picking up, especially if you just concentrate on the years you're actively collecting. Because sometimes I'm going through this and I'm like, oh, I remember Spawn Spogs or Dark Dominion, yes, or the Birth of the Defiant Universe, which was given as a premium giveaway. It actually came with a set of cotton gloves. And of course, now runs for like $200 on the eBays if you try to find it. Or the aforementioned Alpha Flight 106, the North Star screaming, I am gay! And then promptly forgotten for years because Marvel didn't quite know what to do. And they also cover some of the crossovers we were talking about, like when Marvel DC, Darkseid versus Galactus, John Byrne doing Wonder Woman. It's just fun. It's kind of like a memory lane thing. And sometimes it gets me going where it's like, oh, I should find those issues and reread them, which is what I did. And in some cases, I pulled out my trusty hardcover collection of Kingdom Come. I just had the urge to read that and wallow in the craziness that was Alex Ross's art. And of course, they cover in here the fact that Kingdom Come was such a sales hit and that Alex Ross and Mark Waid couldn't get along enough to do a sequel, which was really too bad. But, you know, creators got to create. You know what they're saying? I mentioned aforementioned where the final appearance in Marvel canon that the Superman versus Amazing Spider-Man appeared. Corey did not know where it was. I will tell you, it's in Avengers Forever.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, there's a panel where Doc Octopus has this distinguished-looking bald man on his back. It could be any bald man. We don't know who it is. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Say no more. And of course, when Rick Jones shows up, a future Rick Jones, he has a cape doused across his front with half a logo on it, a very interesting looking a belt around his waist. But
the logo looks like two fish swimming past each other, right?
I don't know what it was. We can't talk about it. But I pulled out Avengers Forever, which I've read, and I might as well have never read it because very little of it did I remember. When I start going through things like this, I start thinking maybe I shouldn't have blown out my collection because I'm going to get to the point where something I haven't seen in ages, I'm going to watch or read it again, and I'm not going to have remembered it, even though
it's new to you.
It's like it's Renew, yeah. And again, Buzak is so, so awesome. He loves his continuity. He knows his continuity. I weep that he's no longer doing Astro City, but I am giddy and waiting in great anticipation for his Marvels series. That
he will
I have
be
no
doing
idea.
Astro City graphic novels, basically.
That's good enough for me, because the continuity he shows in Avengers Forever, and what's fun is, like you said, there's annotated here. So let's just look at one page spread, page 12, 13 annotation. Avengers Assemble. This is chapter 11, not chapter 12. I don't want to go to chapter 12 because we'd be here another hour. So there's a wave of twisted Avengers going after the Avengers that were picked out of time. We see the Hulk from Avengers Annual 12, Kree, Captain America, and Giant Man from Fantastic Four 16, the 98 version, Scarlet Witch from Avengers West Coast 56, Horus Scepter, Captain Isera, and Iron Man from New Warriors 11, and Evil White Tiger and Evil Thor and Galactic Avengers Battalion Soldiers modeled after Hawkeye and Ant-Man. Other evil Avengers appearing in this issue, in this spread page. Thor, Iron Man, Giant Man, Wasp from Avengers Annual 2, Storm from New Warriors 11, 1990, Giant Man from Forever Yesterday timeline depicted in New Warriors 11, various Galactic Avengers. Do I have to go on? Hell, there's a Samantha Hasgard from Clandestine. Iron Man 2020. Just crazy. And I just absolutely love the thing. I mean, so many of these characters, I got to go back and look at, like, wow, I never caught that. So yeah, if you've never read Avengers Forever, give yourself a treat, check it out. I did reread in Infinite Crisis. Having read it in the omnibus form, I should have probably waited and just bought the omnibus, but I got the omnibus. It's sitting on the shelf, but it's fun. I mean, Phil Jimenez's art is awesome. The story's intense. This is one of those, for as groundbreaking as it is, and it's basically Crisis on Infinite Earths, sequel. It really pays to have read everything leading into it, because you are tossed. If you have just the book, like I did, you're tossed into the deep end of the pool and you got to keep wading with it. If you have the omnibus, you have all the crossovers going on with it. So that's a lot of fun. In the I've Never Read It department, and now finally did, Thor by Jason Aaron, volume 1 and 2. Wow. I know where this is going because I read War of the Realms, but it is so much fun to just have been in the beginning and watching this. Characters I didn't care about when She-Thor came around, I suddenly do, because I realize Jason's been weaving a hell of a story. I just hadn't been along for the entire ride. So far, only 2 volumes, bringing us up to and past Secret Wars. Well, up to Secret Wars, I should say. And, of course, I know it goes beyond that, and I know eventually it'll get to War of the Realms. And had I been reading this whole thing the whole time, I probably would have gotten every single War of the Realms crossover. Because, I've been watching on some of the boards, you know, mostly old farts. Oh, they're not doing comics the way I used to. I remember doing it this way, and I like it that way. I don't like these multi-epics. And I'm like, well, that's because you're a putz and comics aren't for you anymore. And you should probably just stick with your reprints and not go outside anymore. But runs like Jason Aaron's Thor, if you're going to be with it, you should be in the middle, in the beginning, because he's dropping clues left and right. And of course, as I was reading it the few times, first time, it's like, you know, well, that's probably why I'm bald, right over my head. Hickman's run on Avengers going into Secret Wars, Brian Bendis's run. Heck, I know there's a lot of people cretching about, I don't like the X-Men. I don't like the way they are. My favorite is, Corey, you pointed out that the whole, we hate mutants because they're different, you know, came along in the Claremont era. That wasn't in the original run of
it was there once in a while when they would do a Sentinel story.
It wasn't their overall theme. Now, right. What drives me crazy in the Marvel Universe is, how do you know Spider-Man looks like a mutant? How do we know what's a mutant, what isn't? To be in such mortal fear of everything. well, that Captain America, he's got to be a mutant. How could he be alone? He's super strong and blah, blah, blah. It's just, it strikes me as fake. And plus the fact that somebody somewhere would have utilized the X-Men's power. Hey, Nightcrawler's instant delivery, you know, instead of him being a priest. Again, whatever. To me, Hickman's X-Men are new. If I want to go read the old ones, I still got my X-Men omnibuses of Chris Claremont stuff. I've got my essentials of the early runs, including the things in between the Last Uncanny X-Men and Giant Size X-Men. I want something new. I don't want what I've read before. And, you know, if you're getting to the point where, these stories aren't for me, they're not for you. I didn't read, what was her name? Ironheart? She became Ironheart, the young lady who was the took over. Yeah. I read it. I said, this isn't for me. I didn't bitch about it. What I found funny is one of our fellow co-podcasters, we ran into me, Dags, and we were, he was crutching. Well, I don't like the fact they made Iron Man a woman. And I said, dude, that's, you're about 6 months out. He's Iron, Tony Stark is back. See, that's what happens. And what's funny is, you know, you're still thinking it's this way, and it was, but it changed.
It was
back.
A story.
But you didn't say anything about Dr. Doom being Iron Man. Why? Because he's a white guy? I don't know. It's that's their issues they got to deal with. You don't like it? You don't have to read it. You know, and I don't talk a lot about stories I stop buying. I'm close to like ending Bendis's run because it's just not doing it for me. And when he said, I'm almost done, I was like, oh, okay, I'll hang to the end. Oh, no, he misspoke. Okay, well, I'm dropping at the 25s like I had planned to. We were talking Superman stories. One of the things I almost made the list for me were the original Superman from Action, back when he was just a bastard.
You just made the list.
Yeah. He, you know, and I know Grant Morrison tried to get that when he did New 52 with his run. It didn't work for me. Maybe I need to sit down and read it as a graphic novel. But again, that I understood what he was doing because Superman wasn't on the side of Law and Order at the time. He was on the side of the everyman. He would knock out the police as much as knock out the mobsters. And he'd do what he needed to do to try to get what he needed. We're not going to talk a lot about this because we're trying to stay positive. But I just started reading Transmetropolitan. And I'm loving it. I've never read this. This was, again, a book that I sold in my comic shop. And I remember reading the first couple ones, and it was just, I wasn't ready for it. I've said that before. There have been other books that I've come back to visit, and I'm like, why didn't I like this when it first came out? Well, that's because I was still thinking superhero. Now I'm looking for something outside my superhero realm. The sad part about it, because of all Ellis's bullshit, I have no idea if I'll ever see any other trade paperbacks of this. I've got one, I've got two, and I wouldn't be surprised if that's all I'll ever get. And I have no idea. I'm pretty sure two doesn't cover it all.
But, it was a 60-issue series, and it's been reprinted a bunch of times.
Yeah, and what I liked about it is they were doing new collection, and I figured I'd just ride along. So I may end up picking the old ones. Again, I like the story. I'm intrigued. I'm having a good time reading it. I don't necessarily support Mr. Ellis and what he's been going through, what he's done. But we've had that conundrum on the podcast before. Where do you separate the work from the creator, and can you enjoy them both? And this one's really fresh. So, again, we don't want to get into it. Go type out. You can figure it out. That's pretty much it. I mean, as far as everything else, this week I worked a full week as opposed to working the weird schedule. So I really didn't have a lot to do. I am looking forward to putting more stuff on the eBays. I really didn't pimp that, but I've ran across, I'm going through my comic boxes downstairs as I'm wont to do. And I'm basically looking to try to get I got the Super Zero from Aftershock. 1, 2, 4, 5, 6. Where's number 3? You know, and I keep running across that as I'm going through various collections, where I'm missing a single issue. Sometimes, like in Marvel's Return to Star Wars, I think it was like I'm missing issue 2. My guess is I probably got one of those super expensive variants, and when it popped up to $40, I sold it, because then I can turn around and buy $40 worth of comics. That's how I tend to operate, folks. So now I have everything but issue 2. And I don't know if I want to go back and find issue 2 just because I want to sell 1 through 25, because I've decided for Star Wars, for the most part, it's more fun in graphic novel form. Or maybe they'll do an omnibus of it, or have done an omnibus, and I couldn't
afford it. There's an omnibus coming out.
Okay, so it's coming. But there are certain runs that I'm going through, and I'm like, almost consistently, they're the same month, which means somewhere, I have a box of all these comics or a pile of these comics that got separated from everything else. And when I find them, I will be able to fill the holes and everything. You know,
they're so alone.
They probably are. And if they talk a little louder, I'll be able to put them together. I did find one box of comics, and it was kind of, I was trying to get it across the table, and the handle ripped, and then comic spill. Oops, stop. Well, when I finally got it safe and looked through it, it's all runs and collections that I had already deemed that I wasn't going to keep. So they'll be going on the eBays, you know. And of course, the best way to figure out what the newer stuff is that I sell is you get to my eBays and get to the storefront. And we talk about it constantly, but the easiest way, I believe, is ebay.com/crazycomicsandstuff, which is the name of the store. In the corner, there's a sort button. Go to newly listed. And if you do that, then you'll see the newest stuff I've listed. And some of it we've talked about. The X-Files conspiracy set, Reddit, Cow 1, 2, and 3. It's there. Die. Wonderful image story. It's gotten to the point with that where I'm just going to buy it as the graphic novel. So, and number one issue that has gone insane, Corey. Oh my God. I can't believe how high it is in price. I got 1 through 10 for $80. There's people got number one slabbed upwards of 200.
Jeez.
I know. It's like one of those things where people weren't paying attention and word got out. And next to that is Amazing Mary Jane 1 through 6, which I read and didn't do it for me, you know, and that's not saying for some people they may like it, but that's the way, I do it, So all these books, hopefully within the next week, I will be up on the eBays, and I already talked my eBay stuff. Enough eBay. Corey, what you geeking on?
I only got to read 2 graphic novels this week, but they were huge. Bruce Wayne Murderer and Bruce Wayne Fugitive. These were, the first one is over 600 pages. The second one's around 400. This was Bruce, they had set up, they'd spent a lot of time setting up this crossover where Bruce Wayne had been dating a woman named Vesper Fairchild, and she was starting to get close to him being Batman, so he ended the relationship. Then he was assigned a bodyguard by Lucius Fox, the board of Wayne Enterprises. So, and his bodyguard, she was able to figure out that Bruce Wayne is Batman. So he brought her along and was training her to be one of his helpers, not a Robin, because there were already like 5 Robins. But they come home from a patrol, and Vesper Fairchild has been killed in his house, in Bruce Wayne's mansion, and the cops show up immediately afterward. Bruce Wayne is arrested for the murder, and the story goes from there. I loved the story when it came out. It started in Batman, the 10-Cent Adventure, because that was something that DC was doing back then. It's okay, we're going to have a big storyline kickoff. We'll do a 10-Cent book. Or a 12-cent book. Then Marvel, of course. Oh, you're going to do a 10-cent book? We're going to do a 9-cent issue of the Fantastic Four.
Why not?
But it's written by Ed Brubaker, Greg Rucka, Devin Grayson, Chuck Dixon. Just a murderer's row of Batman creators and mystery writers. I had forgotten how the mystery all came together, so it was fun to read again, watching it being pieced together. And because Brubaker and Rucka both are excellent mystery writers, they've got red herrings, they've got false leads. It's really a well-done mystery. And the comic itself is fantastic. There are some tie-ins that are like Crisis Red Sky tie-ins where, hey, did you know Bruce Wayne is in prison? Now let's go back to our regular story. But it really is just it's a great story in that it starts in one place and the characters change through the story. One of the things about storytelling that you learn, not in creative writing, because creative writing classes in college and high school are terrible, but when you learn actual writing, is when you get to the third act, your character needs to make a change in order to resolve the story. And in this, we get to where Batman makes a change, and it's just a really fantastically told story with some excellent early 2000s art. It was not the Image scratchy stuff, but more the Rich Burchett, more minimal art, almost animation inspired, very Alex Tothian inspired. And it sets up stuff like the comic Checkmate that Greg Rucka did, and new directions for the Robin and Nightwing comics, and a new direction for Birds of Prey, where it wasn't just, okay, story's over, everybody back to normal. No, they actually used this to kind of do a reset on Batman. It's two trade paperbacks, still in print, still wonderful, highly recommended. Loved reading it. It was fun to read a Batman crossover that took you on that roller coaster ride. The two new comics I read, I don't have them up available, but the first one was Adventure Man, which is by Matt Fraction and done by Terry Dodson, and I love Terry Dodson's art. I think he is in the Dave Stevens school of art, where his figure drawing is beautiful, but he doesn't clutter it with a lot of cross-hatching and extra lines. And you could tell a Terry Dodson. You could tell Terry Dodson art. But it's also a fantastic story in that there was a pulp hero named Adventure Man. And his last story ended with him losing and dying. Well, now it's almost 100 years later. And he's back. So why is that? What's going on? It's from Image. The first issue is actually double size for the regular price. Highly recommended if you are a big fan of pulp stories like The Shadow, The Spider, Doc Savage, things like that. But also you don't need, it's not all nostalgia. It's very much a modern story because Matt Fraction is very good at that. The other number one that I read is from Image called That Texas Blood, which is set in Texas. It's a modern story. An older sheriff is dealing with crime in his very sleepy Texas county where, you know, they haven't had a murder in forever, and now murders have started. I don't have it close by, but it's a number one that came out this week. It's called That Texas Blood. I'll talk about it more next week when I get the creative team. Yeah, when I have it in my hand and can go over the creative team. But I was really impressed with that first issue. Looking at the stuff I like from Image, their crime comics are some of my favorite comics right now. Probably because that's my favorite kind of novel right now, too. So I'll probably be recommending more of that. It looks like Marvel's gearing up to start publishing more and more comics, thank goodness, because I've missed the Marvel Universe. No, they've put out some trade paperbacks. They've put a comic out here and there. But I miss the Marvel Universe. I miss Spider-Man. I miss the Avengers. I miss the Fantastic Four. I want to be immersed in that world once a week again. DC's putting out stuff. I read it sparingly, but I am picking up a few more books because a lot of the Bendis people, such as Greg Rucka and Matt Fraction, are showing up over there. So it's almost like, even if I don't care for what Bendis is doing, and I like his Superman, I don't think it's great, but I like it, he brings a bunch of people with him whose stuff I really like. And I'm kind of surprised that Ed Brubaker hasn't showed up at DC, but he's probably way too busy doing his creator-owned stuff.
It'd be a crime if he didn't.
Your dad joke is supposed to be at the end of the show.
Oh, sorry. My apologies.
Also, last night I watched a movie that I had never seen because because of the packaging. But Turner Classic Movies on Friday nights has Turner Classic Underground, where they show like cult movies and horror movies and stuff that they would not normally show. And I recorded Night of the Creeps. It said it's the director's cut, but actually looking online, it was not the director's cut. Night of the Creeps is this wonderfully strange and fun homage to B-movies. It's a alien invasion movie. It's a zombie movie. It's a slasher movie all in one. Plus, it's because it's in the 80s, it's, slobs against the snobs is in there as well. It was much better than it had any right to be. It was fun to watch. The writer-director has actually gone on to work with Shane Black on movies like Lethal Weapon 4 and things like that. But this was just a very fun homage to 50s B-movies. And the director's cut has a different ending. And the TV cut has a specific ending. And even though Turner Classic Movies said it's a director's cut, it was not. It was the regular theatrical / TV ending and not the director's cut ending. But I liked it more than I probably should have. It was a perfect Saturday night B-movie goofy horror flick. So I'm geeking on that. New Japan Pro Wrestling is back. I probably mentioned it last week, but once we're done, I'm going to be watching the New Japan Cup day one because it's finally available in English. I did watch the Together special they did, but they did not release the English dub, not the English dub, but the English commentary for days later, and I couldn't wait. I had to watch. So, New Japan Cup, I did wait.
How Pat feels about Godzilla movies. Got to get it. Don't care if I understand it.
Yeah, but the Godzilla movies, at least they have subtitles.
Not all of them.
Oh.
He would buy whatever he could get his hands on first, and a lot of times he would get the original, the subtitled, and then, of course, the dubbed. He was crazy.
The dubbed is always the worst. So yeah. That's what I'm geeking on. Believe it or not, kids, you've listened to us blather on about funny books for 2.5 hours.
That was super, man.
And as we say every week, the comic we like the least, we still like better than the comic that you like the most, Joe.
Corey, are you don't eat meat, right?
Correct.
Are you consider yourself vegan or vegetarian?
I'm vegetarian. Vegan means no animal products at all, and I will never give up cheese.
So, yeah. So, basically, if two vegans get into an argument, is it still called a beef?
Ugh.
Or do they say beat, as in, yo, we got you beat because we can squash it right now?
Ugh.
Is it a salad situation? Toss it up. Hit my music.